Hello and welcome to this Friday's edition of Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and my guest, Melanie Griffiths. Hello, Melanie.
Hi.
Hi. Melanie heads up Movement Junkie, and this is part of Melanie's sort of regime and her new business, which derived from Melanie's experience of surviving cancer. Is that right, Melanie?
Yeah.
Yeah. How long ago was that?
So about 12 years ago, I was diagnosed with cervical cancer, stage 3, which is quite serious.
Yes, very much so.
And given the options at the time, the medical diagnosis, prognosis, I suppose, was hysterectomy, radiation of the ovaries, and selective chemotherapy.
Goodness me, that doesn't... None of those options sound good, do they?
No. And I was in my early 30s and hadn't had children, and...
That must have been a real blow for your, you know, mental health and everything. I can't imagine how you could deal with that.
Well, it was a watershed moment in my life, really, because I'd had several years before, I'd had a lot of change and had been travelling around, had moved to the States, so I was living there for a while, had done a lot of work... on around the mind-body field, so I'd learnt a lot to do with how the mind affects the body and how healing can happen. So I was going through that. I was also going through changes in myself, and probably wasn't in a place where I was particularly happy. So I could sense that something was going to come of all of that. So when I got the diagnosis, it wasn't a complete surprise.
Right.
It was more of a case of, that's what's going on.
Okay, so were the doctors going down that route initially? Did they always feel it was that, or were they going out down other areas?
So from the medical perspective, it was, this is what's happening in your body, and this is what we want to do.
What were your symptoms, just for people listening who it might
I had helpful? A smear test, and the smear test came back abnormal.
Right.
And then there were further investigations.
It's always a very frightening moment when you get that letter, isn't it?
And it goes on for a while, over a few months.
Yes.
Until they found, I think it's what's called adenocarcinoma,
right.
And which is when they go, right, okay, you need to have a full-on hysterectomy, etc.
Oh, my word. So when you saw that word in print, that must have been a dreadful moment for
you. Yeah, it brought everything to a head.
Yes.
And I decided, since I'd had the diagnosis, and I think the thing that was really key at that time was everybody around me had a reaction. So I'm suddenly not just dealing with my own reaction to
of course,
what's happened.
Yes.
I'm dealing with
You're
everyone else.
Trying to
else's.
Manage yeah. everybody else being yeah. upset and worried yeah. for you. Yeah. How did you do that?
So what I did was I took a week and I didn't speak to anybody, including doctors, family. So it sort of went into a kind of semi-meditation space. As I was saying, I sort of learnt a lot about the mind and body. So I started to put what I'd learnt into action. The first thing I did was go, right, I'm not talking to anyone for a week.
I think that's an amazing reaction. And I can see how that could be really, you know, work for you.
Yeah. And at the end of the week, what I came out of it was... I was living in the States at the time and married and not in a happy situation, not in a very self-empowered place. And I thought, I know two things. I need to go back home. I need to go back home to the UK, and I need to leave my relationship because it's not working for me. And that's all I knew. And I also sensed that I wanted to take care of my health from a holistic point of view. So I didn't want to do what the doctors were suggesting.
Okay.
So the next thing I did...
How did that go down with the doctors?
Well,
what year was this? Sorry, Melanie, just remind us.
So this is about 12, 13 years ago.
Okay.
And I was in America at the time.
Yes.
And...
So how did they react when you said, I'm not interested in your solutions?
Well, what we did was we had a very long consultation with them, me and my then husband, and who was a lawyer, which was actually quite handy because he was grilling them about what they knew and what they didn't know. And they couldn't really give any definitive answers. So after that, I thought, actually... ridiculous as this might sound, I'm just going to take my life in my hands. So I just moved myself back to the UK. I didn't have any conversation with the doctors over there because I didn't want to deal with their perceptions of what was going on in my body. I thought, if I'm going to do this, I've got to completely believe that I can do this.
And you've got to take control.
I've got to take control. So that's what I did.
Now, that sounds to me like, you know, quite a scary thing to do at that point. Very brave, but very scary.
Yeah. You can't. And I think what happened is all of those emotional centres switched off because I knew what I wanted to do. I thought, I am going to get through this. I'm going to heal from this. I don't know how I'm going to do it at this point, but I'm going to keep my body intact. Because I actually want to preserve the right to have children, yes. Should I want to do that in the future. And that is exactly what I did. So I moved back home and back in with my family, which, if anyone's ever done that...
So how old were you at this point?
32.
Right, and you'd been married, you'd lived in another country, and then you came home and moved back in with your family. Okay.
So there were lots of moments. Yeah. I remember one particular one with my dad, bless him, a difficulty in expressing emotions around what was going on with me, getting rather upset with double glazing being put in the house at the time.
He was.
Yes.
Right.
And eventually, I ended up living with them for about 7 years. And what started off as a very challenging situation became probably one of the biggest blessings of my life because our relationship changed so much and we became very close. We're now very close as a family. And I will never have that time again with them.
No, so like you say, it was a mixed blessing.
Yeah, it became...
And did they support your decision?
Yeah, reluctantly to start with.
Yes.
Very reluctantly to start with because they were scared.
Of course.
And but if you knew me as a child, which obviously they did, and I was always very willful, and when I wanted to do something, that's what I would do. So they knew that there was no point interfering. There was no point sort of doing anything differently. I was going to do what I wanted to do anyway.
Yeah, but of course the stakes were so much higher, weren't they? Yeah. For them as well, obviously, as your parents. It must have been
I think now
terrifying.
Now I look back, I think I didn't realise quite how much they were dealing with because I had my head down. I'm like, right, I'm on this mission. I've got to do this. This is the next thing. This is the next thing. So you're not sort of looking up too much to think, oh, how is everyone else dealing with it?
No, well, you had the biggest...
You're in survival, yeah.
Yes, you were dealing with the biggest thing ever of your life. You were battling that.
Yeah.
So everyone else had to take a backseat,
exactly.
I imagine.
Yes, that's what happened. And I did have to create very strong boundaries with certain aspects of my life, situations and people, because it was a case of, well... I can't afford to tolerate this because I'm in survival. I've got to get well first. Then we can handle whatever that issue is.
Okay.
Over here.
So what was the next step? You moved back home.
I moved back home.
You got your parents on side.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then how did it go?
So then I thought, okay, now what? I'm here. And the first thing I did, I always remember this bit. I went to the library. And I got a book. I knew a lot about nutrition and I knew a bit about healing and I'd experienced both and I'd had other health issues before as well. So there are...
Had you worked in any of those fields?
No.
Nutrition or anything?
No, it was just my own self-discovery really. Picked up a book in the library and it was around vegan cooking. And also at the time I had done some research online, looked up cervical cancer. Most of the information at that time out there was medical, but I came across a woman in America who had a very similar path to me, very similar situation, had gone on to heal herself holistically and went on to have children, and so she preserved her organs. And I thought, right, I printed off her story. I thought, right, well, if she can do it, I can do it.
Yes.
So that was a sort of inspiration. Back to the library, picked up this book. It was all about vegan food, and I thought, okay, I know I've got to do this because I knew that one of the nutritional suggestions is basically starving the tumours. So you've got to take out all the fun foods like fat, sugar, salt, meat, anything like
and
that.
Up to that point, what had your diet been quite good?
Yeah, I mean, I was always conscious, but not rigid.
Right.
And
did you drink, you know, socially?
No, I'm not. I've never been
a big drink.
No, in fact, I haven't really drunk for 20 years. So that was never smoked.
Never an issue, no.
Yeah. So there was nothing extreme going on. And I thought, gosh, this is going to be hard work. And so I flicked through the book and in the back there was an address called the Nutritional Cancer Therapy Trust. And I thought, that sounds interesting. I called them and they had a whole program around nutrition and supplements. And I ended up enrolling on their programme and working with them, which was quite hard work because it was very, very rigid.
Is that a UK-based company?
It is a UK-based company. I'm not sure if they're still going. They might be. But
the principles are this vegan, starving the tumours.
Yeah. Lots of vegetables. There was a lot of vegetable juices. There were some particular supplements which they'd found to be helpful for cancer. And there's a lot of programs out there now
that
work with different aspects of this. So I did that. That was a starting point. And then it was really being, the only way I can describe it, serendipitously guided from one thing to the next.
It does seem that way from what you're saying.
Yeah.
This journey that you've been on, it was almost one step led to the next to the next, didn't it?
Yeah. I actually took up running when I had cancer. Never been a runner in my life. I'd always done a lot of dance.
So what prompted that? Because you must have felt... Did you feel ill with it? Did you feel...
I felt very tired.
Yes. Then what made you think, I'll go running?
I was out walking. That sounds crazy to me. I was out walking one day, and I'd always done a lot of walking, and I just heard this sort of voice in my head. My body said, I want to go faster.
Yeah.
And that was it. And bought some trainers and took up running, and not doing so much of it now. But then it was something about the feet on the ground, head in the air, and I just went.
Mm-hmm.
I could go at whatever pace that was comfortable for as whatever length of time I needed to be running. And I wasn't sort of trying to break any records or anything. It was just for my own fitness.
Yes.
And so it was actually really, really good. And it was something that routinely I was doing every day.
And it's quite cathartic, isn't it?
Yeah.
And you can lose yourself.
Yes.
And just not, and you have to switch off from your worries in a way because you're focusing so much on not falling over and going and,
Exactly. So it had a lot of benefits. I also, did a lot of swimming. I was always a keen swimmer, and again, something I hadn't been doing for a while. Had learned a lot about meditation and started to do that daily, which was really helpful, because with all of the somewhat panic in the system, even if you're not physically panicking, it's in there, it would just help calm things. And I journaled. I wrote every day.
Okay. Just for you, or just did you share that with anyone?
No, it was just for me, and a lot of it was a sort of emotional release. So again, it was very cathartic, and it drew my attention to how I was feeling inside, which I later discovered was a sort of part of how I'd got to where I was, because I wasn't paying attention to my own emotional well-being.
So I see, that's interesting. Have you kept the journal?
I have, yeah. I did pick it up and read it one day, and I thought, oh.
Yeah, so you have revisited it?
I have, yeah.
And do you feel you've really come a long way, obviously, apart from your recovery, but emotionally?
Yes. I could see when I read it that I was quite depressed, and I was sort of feeling very stuck in my life at that time. So something needed to happen to cause a shift.
Yes.
So I really sort of see it as a watershed, that time. And it's definitely served a purpose. It's sort of put me more on track with where I kind of wanted to go. But it kind of, with other things that were going on in life, got a bit sort of lost. So
you were eating healthily.
Yeah.
You'd taken up exercise.
Yeah.
So how often were you running?
I was probably running daily.
How long for, roughly?
Half an hour to up to an hour, depending on energy levels.
Yes.
I was regulating everything on how I was feeling energetically.
So kind of body was your guide. Yeah.
I think there was a lot of adrenal stuff going on as well. So actually the running kind of calmed me down.
Yes. So, I know exactly what you mean.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you can feel full of very negative energy, can't you?
Yeah.
And whether that's stress or whatever, worry, and running seems to literally run it out of you, doesn't it?
Yeah. And that's how it felt. Yeah. Exactly.
And so anything else?
So then I was drawn to sort of different books to read. There are two key books I remember that I always, when I'm talking to people now about cancer, I always recommend they read. One of them is called Love, Medicine and Miracles. And it's by a surgeon called Bernie Siegel.
So Love, Medicine and Miracles by Bernie Siegel.
Bernie Siegel. And he was a surgeon out in Connecticut for 20 years, and he observed the traits of patients who had cancer, those who survived and those who didn't, and his books are about that. So he straddles that line between medical, conventional wisdom and holistic, which I think is nice, because although I chose the route I chose, I think that medicine has, conventional medicine has wisdom in it too.
Okay, so we'll come on to that in a minute.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
he almost gave sort of tacit approval of, yeah, of your,
yes,
method, if you,
yeah,
will.
Exactly. Okay. That's such a good way of putting it, yeah.
And
the other one that really played a big role is a book called The Journey by a woman called Brandon Bays. And Brandon had her own experience with cancer and healed herself holistically, and documents her story.
And was her cancer similar to your cancer?
She had a pelvic mass, so it was more attached to the uterine, right, area, but not, you know, a million
not
miles
too
away.
Dissimilar.
Yeah, yeah. And she talks a lot about what was going on in her life, the changes she made, and the ups and downs, which I found quite powerful, because it isn't a straight road coming out of it. And there are many kind of turns.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And they never stop, really.
Did you have any support in terms of any counselling?
No, it's interesting. I did try and go to a clinic that was attached to the hospital, and this was when I was in Sussex. And I think I went a couple of times, but I didn't find it helpful for me.
Right.
Bizarrely. It just I don't know how to describe it, but when I was in my own space on my own, I felt very focused and very positive. And when I went to the clinic, which was very well intentioned, and they offered all kinds of holistic support, I just sort of felt like a victim of my own situation. And I didn't actually feel like that.
Right.
If I don't know if that makes sense.
I do understand, yeah.
So I thought, well, actually, that's not making me feel where I want, how I want to feel.
Yeah, not making me feel any better.
So
yeah,
I'm going to go back to what I was doing.
Yes.
So I did a lot of it on my own. A lot of it, particularly like the internal work.
Did you ever get to the point where you thought, actually, this just isn't working? You know, I can't carry on like this. I'm going to have to do something else, take another path. Or were you always absolutely convinced that your decision was the right one for you?
I think underneath, that was always the foundation, that that's the right decision. And it was just a question of which direction now, which kind of branch of the tree now, which...
Okay.
And I was guided to, there was a healer that I was guided to from, it was sort of someone I met at an event who mentioned this particular person. And then I went to see them, and she was trained as a nurse and a homeopath, had also done a lot of psychic work, and working with her was very helpful because she was very good at pinpointing. It wasn't about creating more diagnosis, it was about going, well, you're doing great, but here we can tweak the balance a bit more so we can strengthen you further. So that was an addition. And I saw her probably for about 2 years, but only about once every 6 months.
I see. So how long was the healing process?
It was about 4 years, because I got to a point where I thought, I woke up one morning and I thought, oh, I think I'm ready to go and have a smear test.
Why did you think that?
I don't know. It just popped into my head.
And this was 4 years later, just to be clear. Yeah.
Probably about 3 years later.
Right.
So this was about 3 years later.
So 3 years of running, sort of strong physical exercise,
yeah,
and following a vegan diet.
Yeah.
Nothing else?
No, I went back to my dancing. I was...
Exercise.
Yeah.
So it's,
yeah,
physical,
so
exercise,
yeah,
and,
yeah,
a vegan diet.
Yeah.
And no other intervention at all?
No medical intervention, no.
So then you woke up and you thought, I'm going to...
I just thought, I think it's time.
Right.
So I went to our local doctors and I said, can I have a smear test? So we tried to book that in, and for one reason or another, it didn't happen. Either I had a period and they couldn't do the test, or something else happened. So I thought, okay, it's not time. There's too much struggle here.
But wasn't your doctor very anxious to get that test done under the circumstances?
No, because I'd left one doctor in America, come back to the UK, and didn't involved doctors at that point.
So you said nothing?
Yes, I said nothing.
Your doctor had no clue.
Right, exactly.
That you had cervical cancer.
Yeah.
So you just went in and said, can I have a smear test?
Exactly, yeah.
Right.
So
how do you feel about that now? Do you feel...
I feel okay with it, but I would say when I'm working with people, because I now work with people, I wouldn't necessarily advocate that kind of path to anyone else, but I know what I'm like. So I've always been fairly maverick, so I tend to kind of... I go, that's what I would do. So that's, but I wouldn't say to someone else, take your life in your hands. And, I'd say take a more balanced approach. But it didn't happen. And I left it, I let it go. And I think it was probably another 6 months or so later, I made another attempt to get a smear test. I think I went to a different surgery and we did the test and it came back clear.
Wow.
And yeah, it was amazing.
I mean, that moment.
I know.
That must have been so amazing.
I know. It was, well, I suppose for me it was quiet because I'd been on the focus of the whole, the healing the whole time.
Yes.
But I think what kind of really gave it that validity was we decided to have a party.
I think you should have definitely decided to have a party. I'm so pleased to hear that.
And that was when it hit me.
Yeah.
I think that's when it hit me what I'd been through. Because up to that point, and I didn't realise it until that point, I've been putting my emotions on hold.
Of course.
To get through things. And so after that point, I think I was probably very emotional, very tearful. And I went, oh my goodness, I've just gone through this journey. Which didn't have that sense about it when I was going through it, because I was just doing the very next thing.
I think that's often the way with very strong emotional journeys. You're so focused on the next step.
Yeah.
You're not aware of how you feel or what you're doing or, and other people can comment afterwards and say, whatever did you do that for?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And you think, but you weren't walking in those shoes at that point.
Yeah, exactly.
So how did your parents react?
They were really... elated, and I think that's when I saw the emotion in them. But our relationship had been changing over the years anyway, so they were really happy and
relieved.
Yeah,
immensely relieved, I think, as you all must have been.
Yeah.
Did you contact your ex-husband at all? Or?
Yes, we'd stayed in touch through the whole process. Yeah. We had a very amicable separation, and it took us a few years to properly get divorced anyway. It just wasn't the right relationship. So when we made the decision, it was just a natural.
Yes.
But he was a part of that journey.
But it must... I'm welling up here, but it sounds like a miracle. Is that... Did you feel that sense of wonder and amazement, or did you
I think there are moments when I have that.
Yeah.
But I think... And I think because you're so focused, or I was so focused on what I was doing next, the very next thing... It sort of feels like my head was down, like studying for an exam, and I wasn't lifting it up enough to go, oh, look how far I've come.
Yes.
And so you don't necessarily have that sense of it's a miracle until someone actually reflects that back to you. I think that when I started to tell people my story, they'd go, oh, wow, that's amazing. And I think, well, I just did what I instinctively thought to do.
Because just sort of going to recap, your cancer at the stage they've initially identified was quite far down the road.
Yeah, and just to give you a parallel, which happened years later, there was a reality television star, because since I was diagnosed, reality shows had kicked off.
Is this Jane Goodish?
Yes. Had exactly the same cancer.
Right.
And sadly, she didn't survive.
Hers was such a quick... Yeah. demise, it seemed to be from that diagnosis, which was live broadcast from the Indian Big Brother, I think, wasn't it?
That's right.
That she was very ill, wasn't she?
Yeah. And that's how it could be. And cervical cancer can have that, the hormones can change quite quickly in either direction.
I see.
So I suppose when I look back now, I really was taking my life in my hands. But
would you do it again? If
Yeah, definitely, because I couldn't have... carried. I looked at the option, I can have a hysterectomy, etc., but I won't deal with any of the underlying issues, so I'll still feel the same inside. I just won't have parts of my body, so I might as well deal with the issues that are underlying the health problem, and And that's what really changed my well-being, was being able to do that.
Okay, well, that's just fascinating. And thank you so much for your honesty and for sharing this with us. And I can't wait to talk to you some more after the break. Okay, back.
The Lunchtime Social Debate, brought to you by Real Employment Law Advice, your legal lighthouse guiding you through a sea of employment law. A solicitor's firm with a difference. Go to realemploymentlawadvice.co.uk for more information.
This is Vectis Radio.
For the people, by the people.
The Castle in St Helens offers 4-star self-catering accommodation in 2 properties sleeping up to 7 people. The properties have secluded grounds with off-road car parking just a few minutes' walk away from the beach and a village green. St Helens is a charming village, and the Castle is an excellent base for your Isle of Wight holiday, whether you want to explore all the island has to offer or just get away from it all. We're open all year, dogs are welcome, and short breaks are available. Go to our website at www.sthelenscastle.co.uk for full details of prices and availability, or call us on 01983 875 993, that's 875 993, to find out more or to book your ideal getaway.
Having problems with your phone? Or are your electrics on the blink? Maybe you need your appliances or your building wiring tested, or just a light fitted. West Wight Audio and Electrical Services can help you. For friendly, reliable service, call Kelvin on 754666 or click westwhiteaudio.co.uk. All island coverage.
Beds of Ride, in-town parking in Union Street. Come and give your bedroom an overhaul and treat. No need for sales gimmicks, just value for your pound. With realistic prices all the year round. Includes free delivery if you live in Ride, and only £10 elsewhere island-wide. Open 10:30 till late, 6 days a week. All that is needed to help you sleep. Beds of Ride, call 565 151. Also find us on Facebook.
Solent, the ultimate scent for men. Do you like your man to smell fresh? As fresh as the catch of the day? Solent, the scent of the sea, the number one aftershave in the south. Solent by Vectis.
If you've got a wicked sense of humour and you like a laugh, why not tune in to us every single Thursday, 10 till 1, it's Macca and the Floozy, only on Vectis Radio.
Stay social and get in touch. It's / Vectis Radio on Facebook. The World Wide Web never felt so local.
The Lunchtime Social Debate, brought to you by Real Employment Law Advice, your legal lighthouse guiding you through a sea of employment law. A solicitor's firm with a difference. Go to realemploymentlawadvice.co.uk for more information.
Hello and welcome back to Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and my very special guest this week, Melanie Griffiths. Welcome back, Melanie.
Hi.
And we've been talking about Melanie's recovery from cervical cancer, which you engineered yourself completely holistically, didn't you? We've been hearing that it was all, you did a vegan diet and you took up very strenuous exercise, considering how tired you must have been feeling.
Yeah.
And you said you went back, you felt, you know, this, you had this wonderful sort of feeling after about 3 years of this that you'd go back to the doctor, not having told the doctor in England, having been diagnosed first in America.
Yeah.
Came back to England and you didn't fess up to the doctor.
Yes,
that
quite.
You had this history.
Yeah.
And then, you know, a little while later, you didn't initially have the test, but a little while later you discovered that the test was negative. I mean, just wonderful, wonderful news.
Yeah.
So did you tell the doctor? Did you say, look, this is what I did?
No, I don't think I did, actually. I think because at the time, I mean, I'm not sure how things are now, but at the time there was still a lot of, not animosity, I'm trying to think of the word, disregard for the holistic world. And I still felt quite vulnerable in my own healing journey. So I thought, actually, I'm just going to carry on.
Even
with,
that negative result to say you didn't have the cancer.
Yeah.
You still felt vulnerable.
Yeah, because going back to Bernie's book, which is one of my favourite books, Love, Medicine, Miracles, he tried very hard to straddle both sides, and he had cases that he took back to his colleagues of people who'd miraculously healed themselves, and their colleagues said, or his colleagues said, there was obviously no cancer there to start with.
Right.
So I thought,
you can understand that scepticism, can't you? Especially in the medical world.
Yes, exactly. Yes. And I just thought, actually, I don't want to be on the receiving end of that.
That negativity.
Yeah. I just want to enjoy my life and help and support other people do the same for them if I can do that.
And give them hope.
Yeah.
But I suppose I think it's important to mention that obviously everybody's cancer is different.
Completely, yeah.
And everybody's at a different stage and a different type, and their situation and circumstance physiologically, mentally is totally different.
Yeah.
So what you did, as you said, you know, you were a maverick.
Yeah.
And you, and to quote you, you said you took your life into your own hands.
Yes, yeah.
And I'm right in saying you wouldn't, you know, recommend that. But no, that's what you wanted to do.
Yeah.
I think we need to just be clear for people, anybody out there to say...
Yeah, you know, one of the things I learned as I went through this journey was actually your belief systems are really important, your basic belief systems. So if somebody has a very strong faith in the medical profession and that's where they're getting their diagnosis from, that's probably what they need to follow.
That's very interesting. And perhaps likewise, people with faith, you know, a strong faith, whatever that may be, that they can lean on that. I mean, not necessarily find a cure through that, but lean very heavily, I suppose, in that area.
Yeah. And for me, I had always been interested in holistic things. As a child, I was interested in all things spiritual and looking after my health. So that was kind of a natural step for me, really, to go in that direction. And I realised, actually, probably for me, had I gone against my own instincts, I might not be here today. Yes. So it would be the same for someone else if their instincts were to go in a different direction and they followed a path that didn't make sense to them. Then that's where it becomes...
I think having met you and spoken to you, I think you had to do what your heart and your mind was telling you to do.
Yeah.
I don't. Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yes, I can see that. So, though, are you still vegan?
No, Melanie. No. When I started working with the healer that I'd been recommended to, who'd did a lot of different things, she put me back to eating meat because my body actually responds better to an animal protein diet. So this is my body overall.
Yes.
And I lost a lot of weight.
When you were vegan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm not a large person anyway. No. So it didn't really suit me overall. And because the threat was gone and my body needed the sustenance of animal protein, I went back to eating animal protein.
Right. And what about the sugar and things like that?
So now my diet is in a much more relaxed way, but I still pay attention, and if things get out of hand, I have to bring them back into balance. So it's very vegetable based, good sources, clean sources of protein. I do love chocolate.
Yes.
And don't we all? Yeah. And I don't think deprivation is the answer. I mean, I could do a whole thing on nutrition because I don't think deprivation is the answer as a long-term plan. It doesn't work.
I think a little of what you fancy, or a lot in the case of chocolate. In my case, far too much of what I fancy.
But actually, dark chocolate's been proven to be very good for you.
Yeah, but only that really bitter, dark stuff.
Yeah, but that's the stuff I like.
Oh, right. See, I can't. That gives me a headache.
Yeah, it will
It's very intense, isn't it?
It's got certain chemicals in there.
It's almost like a caffeine shot, isn't it?
Yeah.
So what do you ration yourself to on that?
Oh, gosh. It varies depending on the levels of stress I'm dealing with.
But you say you don't drink.
No, I don't.
And presumably you don't smoke.
No, I don't drink and I don't smoke.
So you've got to have some pleasures, haven't you?
Exactly, yeah. And and because I now teach exercise, I do a lot of physical movement. And I'm mindful about getting enough rest and I keep up the meditation.
You burn it all off anyway, don't you?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. My philosophy now, which I say to people in classes, is which I don't know whether it's advisable to tell people, but it's run up a hill and eat what you like. Because I
when you get to the top, if you ever get to the top, then you're allowed it.
I just don't think any level of depriving the body of food is a long-term plan, which I've said, because I think the body rebels against it eventually.
Yes, and it starts to store fat and all sorts, doesn't
exactly.
it? But that reminds me of a story I was, when I used to live in London, One day I ran up Highgate Hill, and that is one hell of a hill, I can tell you. And it was in order. I would used to jog every day then anyway. And I thought, well, I'll make it a mission. So it's not just a jog around the park. I've actually got a purpose to this run. And I ran up the hill, and there was a chocolate shop. There still is a chocolate shop in Highgate Village, selling beautiful Belgian truffles. And I thought, I'd buy a box for my husband for his birthday. So up I shot up this hill with this lovely incentive, only to find that the shop was closed. So furious was I belted back down this hill, having nearly killed myself getting up it, belted back down it, only to go over a loose paving stone and then do that kind of Superman, Superwoman flying thing.
Yeah.
And I was parallel and I was facing the pavement, you know, my head down. And I still thought I can come out of this, even though I was, you know, 12 inches off the ground, flying along. I thought that I can come through this. No. Slam back. So hard did I go down that a passing motorist stopped and said, can I take you to the hospital? I should have said yes, but I said, no, I'll be fine, you know. Then continued to jog home, only to have cracked a couple of ribs. Of course, there's nothing they can do. No. So, you know, just there was no running for me for a while and no chocolates for my husband for a long, long time, I might add.
A cautionary tale.
Yes, indeed. So I'm not sure about you running up your hill and eating what you like. Really. Only if the chocolate shop at the top is open.
Yes.
So did you ever think, when you were doing this, that this just may not work? It may not be enough, the diet and exercise. I might have to go back to the medical profession and get some other help, get some intervention. Get some drugs.
I think I thought it might not work.
Mm.
And then I thought, well, and this will sound bizarre. I thought, well, the worst case scenario is I die, which sounds crazy. But I thought, well, I wasn't happy in life anyway.
Oh.
And I really wanted to keep my body parts. So that's kind of where my mindset was. So it wasn't ever a question of going back to the doctors, because I thought, I know I was struggling so much emotionally.
Yeah. Do you think you were depressed at that point?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I felt like I was I was kind of stuck in a corner in my life. It was like a sort of a corner I didn't know how to get out of.
And did you ever think, I just can't do this anymore? I just can't. It's too much. It's too much on my own. It's such a big thing I'm battling.
I think there were definitely probably moments.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And a lot of it had to do with being back home living with family. Where do I go from here? Do I go back to the States? Do I stay in the UK? What happens next? So there was a lot of that sort of thinking as I was getting beyond just physical survival.
Mm. Physical and mental survival, I think. Because it's got to be, you know, not mind over matter by any stretch of the imagination. But I mean, in order to do it the way you did it, you must have really had to kind of struggle sometimes
to keep
on track mentally.
Definitely. And I think days there were, I definitely wasn't on track, but I kept going, if that makes sense.
Were you working? Did you have a
No,
job?
I wasn't working, which was, I think, a blessing and a curse, because the blessing was I had the space to kind of take on my own healing. It became a curse when actually I probably needed another purpose other than just recovering from cancer. And I think that's when I started to, my business started to kind of...
Because I was going to say, how did you survive 3 years? It's a long time.
Yeah.
3-4 years is a long time. Yeah. How did you survive financially?
Financially, I had support from my husband and parents.
Oh, I see.
Yeah,
I see.
So it was coming from both sides.
So
we were still in touch. So there was support coming from there and there was support from parents. And I started to do, going back a little bit, when I was in California, I trained at a place called the Berkeley Psychic Institute. And that's about working with the mind-body field and using the intuition to work with someone's energy field and counselling. So I got to a point with the healing where I started to feel strong enough and I thought, you know what, I want to work with other people. So I made a little card and I put it in the local Londis shop window
That was here on the island?
No, no, this is back in Sussex.
Right.
Yeah. And I, people started to call me, and I said, you know, can you work with me? So I started to do intuitive counselling work with people. So I started to bring in money like that.
So just for, you know, people like me who don't know, what is intuitive counselling in layman's terms?
Right. Okay. So I'm trying to think how to describe. So the body has an electromagnetic field of energy around it, which psychics call the aura. Scientists call the electromagnetic.
Aye, I've heard of the aura. Yes.
Yeah. And it reveals frequencies. So, which to someone who is intuitive, they can tap into and literally read. So for me, it will give me messages. I will see mental image pictures. I will get a sense of what's going on with that person.
Okay. So if I'm a total skeptic, that would, I'd be very difficult for you to work with, I guess.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah,
so you
exactly.
need somebody who is on your wavelength in a way with that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the hilarious thing is, my first client was the mother of the local doctor.
Oh, goodness me.
Who herself had cancer, which I remember when she told me, I thought, oh, my goodness.
Please tell me her story had a happy ending.
I think so, yes. We just did one session, but she, she carried on.
And now you've gone in, you've got a company, a movement junkie.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So I went
tell us about that.
Yeah. So I went on to, I realised I wanted to work with people in the mind-body field. So I as I was coming through the cancer, I thought, what do I want to do? I've got space in my life. What do I want to do with my life? And I thought, well, I really want to take my skills and my experience and help other people. So this is where Movement Junkie was born. And it started off being intuitive counselling and then hands-on healing work, which is a similar kind of thing to the counselling, but you're laying hands on the body, so you're moving your sort of frequencies around the body.
So it's like a healing hand?
Yes, and very similar to Reiki,
yes,
which most people have heard of.
Yes.
And during part of the recovery, I started to go back into dance, which I had done from the age of 3 up till 18 solidly. So I'd done ballet, tap, jazz, modern, and I was training as though I was going to go on and do it professionally.
Yes.
But had a sort of an about turn at 18 and thought, no, I don't think that's what I want to do. So I had all that information.
So what did you think you wanted to do at 18? I don't think we do know what we
wanted to do.
We have to get in a box, don't we, at 18 and decide.
Exactly.
So what did you think? Not the ballet, not the tap.
It was, I didn't want the pressure. That's what I learned later in life.
Right.
When I came back to dance, it was the pressure of performance, the pressure of technical training. I actually ended up doing a business degree, but that's
a whole different kind of pressure, I'd say, and not
exactly.
so much fun.
Yes. So as I was, when I came back into dance from having cancer, it was about how is it nurturing for my body?
You came back on your terms by the sound of it.
Yeah. It was about the joy of movement.
Yes.
What do I get out of it? And so I started training in a technique called NIA, which stands for Neuromuscular Integrative Action, and is basically something that came out of California, and it's a mind-body approach to movement. And I did a lot of their classes and then went on to train as a teacher in that system. And that formed the basis of my first movement classes.
Right.
Coming from having cancer. I now don't teach NIA, but I draw from the information and use a lot of my own.
So you do a mix now,
I
your own
mix,
stuff
yeah.
and
yeah.
that. Okay,
yes.
So are those classes here on the Isle of Wight?
Yes, yeah.
Where are they?
They are in Ryde, Cowes, and I'm probably going to be doing something in Ventnor in September.
So how often do you do these?
So Ryde, I've got Monday night and tonight, Wednesday night.
They're going to rush off there.
And that's a dance fitness class that I call Dance Groove. And that grew out of my love as a teenager of going to nightclubs and dancing to music when nightclubs were good. And I thought, I used to love that.
So can anybody join in?
Yes.
Even somebody like me with no sense of
absolutely.
Rhythm. Real old hoofer who just hasn't got a clue.
Absolutely. The classes are meant to be fun. They're meant to be fun and get you exercising without you realising that's what you're doing. So I always do... So in the dance groove class, we'll do a little bit of Brazilian samba, bits of salsa, disco, jive, Bollywood, belly dance.
Sounds very energetic.
Yeah. You actually work the whole body is the idea. So I combined what I've done now is I combined my dance experience with my fitness training, which I then went on to do, to create a class that has a balance of what's good for the body from a fitness side, but the creativity of dance.
Yes.
So that's the dance groove. I also have a dance yoga class, which is a blend of different, again, different types of movement and dance, but slower, simpler patterns of choreography, world music. And it's more about moving from the inside out. So it's about sensory movement. So although we're following sequences, patterns, you're following them from the space of how is this feeling in my body? So rather than trying to create a shape from the aesthetic perspective of how does this look, which is what a lot of performance dance is about.
Yes.
It's about how does this feel?
Yes, and that's better for someone like me who would obviously look a complete wreck, throwing his limbs about.
Never use words
out
like
of time.
That.
No, but my sister-in-law always says, you know, you've got absolutely no sense of rhythm. And I said, no, but I love it.
That's the main thing.
Getting up and getting down to Tom Jones or Rod
Stewart.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's what I try and
aware I probably look a complete fool, but hey-ho.
That's what I try and bring into all the classes is movement should be fun. It's not about what is the best movement, what is going to get me thin or fit. It's about what do you enjoy, what does my body enjoy doing?
And the more you enjoy it, the more you're going to do it and stick with it,
exactly.
Aren't you?
Exactly. So I personal train people as well now. And that's one of the things that I, when I'm putting together a program, that's the first place we start is, well, what do you enjoy doing? Because there's no point giving someone exercise that they hate.
Yeah, no, exactly.
They're going to do it.
No.
So, yeah.
And you've got, I can see, you've cycled to the studio today. So how often do you go out on your bike?
Well, we're novice cyclists. We've just started.
That's you and your partner.
Yeah, yeah. And so as much as we can in the summer, at the weekends, but we just kind of, it's like, you know, you learn to cycle as a child.
Yes.
And if you don't do it for years, you get back on a bike and it's like, oh, I've got to get the balance back on.
But it is riding a bike, you know, they say you're supposed to just be able to do it.
Yeah.
But it is, it's quite, I think as a kid you did it around the park, on the pavement, and then when you get on as an adult, you have to be an adult and go on the road, don't you?
Yes.
Be a grown up.
Yes.
And deal with other traffic
exactly.
and know what you're doing.
Yeah.
You can't, like say, go out there like a novice and just make a nuisance of yourself.
Yeah, you've got to have balance because you've got to be clear with your signals.
And be confident, haven't you?
Yeah. I mean, I'm fascinated by movement in myself, so I'm always exploring different kinds of activity, anything that I'm drawn to that will be part of my own well-being program. So cycling is just one of the latest things that I've picked up.
So going back to your movement junkie,
yeah.
If anybody's interested in coming along to a class, how do they find out about it?
So they can either contact me through the website, which is movementjunkie.co.uk.
Okay.
They can contact me via Facebook. I have a Movement Junkie page. And I also, for people on the island, because I still teach back in Sussex as well.
Yes.
But for people on the island, I have an Isle of Dance and Fitness page, which is just dedicated to island dancing. Anybody interested in the healing side of things, I have a page called Magic Isle of Healing, which has my meditation group, both the island one, and I still run one in Sussex as well.
Okay.
So, but all the information is also
You're
on the website.
Very busy bunny.
I know.
Do you go to the gym? I shouldn't imagine you've got time, but it's just something we haven't touched on.
No, it's interesting. When I did trained to be a personal trainer, which is something I wanted to do as part of my fitness training, I had to learn how to use all the equipment in the gym.
Yeah.
And I wasn't a gym person. And it was alien to start with. And I thought... And at first I thought, oh, I don't like this. Why do you do this, etc.? Why would someone come in here when they could be either outside or in a class? But what I discovered about the gym is it's particularly good if people have mobility issues.
It's very static movement.
It's very static. Yeah. Or they've had severe illness or injury, and it will help support them and get them back.
And it builds up the bone, doesn't it? The calcium in the bones.
Yeah.
I was actually reading something now, probably, I think this must be in London, but they're thinking of introducing a bus and it will have the spinning bikes on it.
Oh, wow.
So you can spin to work, in effect, but be driven by the bus. So you're dry, you're warm, and you're safe. But I thought, how does that work? You know, you've only got to take a bus driver to brake sharply and everybody goes shooting off the back of their bike. So, but yeah, I mean, I'll agree with you, you know, get out in the fresh air. But I suppose it's not always possible for everyone.
No, it's horses for courses.
Exactly. Yeah. Everybody's so different to their approach to exercise, aren't they? And how much time they're willing to give it and how much discomfort they're willing to go through.
Yeah, because some people really don't like exercise, but they know they need to do it. So that's going to be all about convenience and what's the shortest amount of time they can put for the most benefit.
What can they get away with?
Yeah. Some people just love exercise and that's great because they'll go and do anything. So it's an anywhere in between.
I think we're so lucky on the island because we've got these beautiful open spaces.
Yes.
And there's Walk the White. There's so many initiatives that people can get in to cycle around the White and everything. It's, I mean, we've got some killer hills here, haven't we? But real challenges, but just such a reward in the beautiful scenery.
Yeah.
It's just fantastic. Just very quickly before, do you still have your regular smear tests?
Yes, I do. Yeah.
And that's very important to you.
Yeah. And they've come back clear and, I lose track of time because you still go on to the next thing, the next thing, the next thing. So, yeah, they've been coming back clear for the last 12, 13 years.
And
also, not 12. That's when I was diagnosed. So about the last eight.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
I mean, And if the worst happened again, what would you do? You'd take the same approach?
Yeah, it's interesting. I've had those thoughts. I thought, what would I do? Yeah, I probably would. I'd probably stop life as it is now, take stock, and then kind of go, what do I need to do? And put together a programme from there.
I just think it's amazing that you could do that kind of stepping back at that point, because I'd just go into blind panic, you know. But I think if you've got that ability in life, in any kind of crisis, to be able to step back and just be calm and think what's right for you, I think that pays dividends. But as we said earlier, your approach, and I think it is important to emphasise, mate, is not right for everybody.
No,
and
definitely
obviously
not.
You know, the medical profession just do wonderful surgery and you know,
absolutely,
drug intervention and save lives. So it's very important that people engage with their doctors and things.
Yeah.
So, Melanie, thank you. You really have, and I know you're a member of the Inspiring Women on the Isle of Wight and the Isle of Wight Business Ladies, of course, but I mean, you really are the definition to me of inspiring. I think your story is absolutely incredible. So thank you so much for being so honest and sharing that with us today.
You're welcome.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Jo.
So thanks to Melanie. And please join me next week when I will be talking to our very own Ian Mack. I can't wait to discover the man behind the mic. So I think that's one not to miss. Okay, have a lovely weekend. Enjoy the sunshine. And I'll speak to you then. Bye-bye.